Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we hear about what people in New York think about women.
There are a lot of people who are carrying these perceptions that women aren't as good, that women are to blame for their abuses, that women aren't as well trusted.
And we hear about the first Asian American Women's Act to star in Broadway musical reviews. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. And for my healing wins, Women at Work's View on Women poll was created through the Benjamin Center at the State University of New York at New Paltz, supported by the Times Union, and conducted by the Siena College Research Institute. It's the first time New York adults' feelings about women were measured in a single survey. The poll intentionally was planned to correspond with the 2017 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in New York, with hopes for a national poll in 2020 to mark the 100th anniversary for the nation. Dr. Eve Waltermoer is Director of Research and Evaluation at the Benjamin Center for Public Policy Initiatives. I asked her why she thought the New York View on Women would make a good survey topic.
Well, right now it's 2017, and women got our right to vote in New York State at least 100 years ago. And in the last 100 years, we've had a lot of new laws and policies put into place with the idea of improving the condition for women and more so to create equality between the genders. So we have seen laws in terms of intimate partner violence. We've had laws saying that a husband in fact can commit rape. We've had laws on equality in pay and discrimination in the workplace. But despite this, in this evolution of 100 years of laws and policies, we still don't see equality between the genders, and we still have similar rates of rape and partner violence perpetrated today. We don't see strong representation in the government by women. We don't see equal pay. And so it leads to the question, why is there this continued inequality between men and women? Because there are all these laws and policies in place to encourage equality, if there is inequality, there are some who might argue that it's the woman's fault, that women make the decision to take the jobs that pay less or to be involved with partners who might be abusive or to not work at all, to not engage in the STEM fields. And so we have to wonder where, if rules and policies are in place, why don't we have the equality? And one of the big things that's been missing all along is this question of social perceptions, of attitudes. And I would liken it to, if you have a stop sign in a very busy urban area where people recognize the need to stop because there are pedestrians, there's other cars coming all the time, then people will stop. But a stop sign in a very rural, quiet, sleepy road where you drive all the time and you feel like, I never see anybody here. This is really nobody's business but my own if I stop. You don't see it as necessary, perhaps, to stop. The law is exactly the same. You see a stop sign, you're supposed to stop. But your decision to pay attention to it or not is based on your attitude. And so the important question was, well, what are people's attitudes about women? What are people's attitudes about these policies? What are people's attitudes about women in terms of the home, in terms of work, in terms of education, family, media? And the problem was we didn't know. We had no, there was no metric on social perceptions towards women. There are a few surveys here and there that will ask, do you think inequality still exists? or some very generic kinds of questions, but never in one place did we have a measure of what people really think about women in the various different spheres of where women exist. And so I joined up with other academics. I'm an epidemiologist with a focus on violence, but I joined up with two political scientists and a PhD in education, and we pulled together the survey and looked for funding. And fortunately, Times Union Women at Work saw the benefit of such a poll and supported us and allowed us to basically, for the first time, not only in New York State, but in our country, start measuring in one central place what people really think of women. And so we have over 50 questions, and we did surveys with 1,050 adults in New York State, across the entire state, asking them questions such as reasons why they think women are rape and sexually assaulted, whether women are as smart in math and science as men, various questions to get at what people truly think about women.
So with your work in social and behavioral research, what did the poll show you? How did it inform you?
Well, what was interesting is when I started pulling these questions together, my colleagues who they're in these fields, but the whole social perception perspective was strongly mine, questioned me and said, Eve, do you really think that people would ever say yes, that it's okay for a husband or a partner to beat his wife or girlfriend if she doesn't know when to shut her mouth? And I said, I'm afraid I do think there will be. And they were surprised. I mean, I'm sad that I was right, but I was right. And so what we found, and there's a lot of this information is slowly being released by Women at Work. But for example, we know that one third of men who are 26 to 35 think that men are better at science and math. We have, I believe it was over one third of all people identifying that how a woman dresses, if she dresses provocatively, it is a cause of rape. We have, I believe it was about a quarter who believe that one of the contributors of a husband or spouse or husband or boyfriend hitting his girlfriend or spouse because she didn't know when to shut her mouth. And so there are a lot of people who are carrying these perceptions that women aren't as good, that women are to blame for their abuses, that women aren't as well trusted. As someone in media, you might want to know that one in five men trust male experts over female experts. And we have very few people who believe that we need more women in Congress. We have one-fifth of men who think that men are better in business than women. So we have a long way to go.
So what does this say about policy? I mean, here we are both federally and as individual states passing policies to help protect women, to help advance women. Clearly not enough, but they're there. And now comes this poll, the answers to which have nothing to do with policy. So then what do we need to do going forward to address the root of these perceptions?
Well, that's a great question. The first part is recognizing that perceptions play a big part. Most of my research has been on violence against women. I've been studying it for 20 years. And this has been a big issue for many intimate partner violence researchers, is this idea, this understanding that if everyone doesn't think this behavior is wrong, then how are we supposed to change it? If everyone doesn't think it's wrong, then what stops the offender from doing it? What makes the victim even think she should tell somebody? Why should the police officer do anything? And why should the judge care if people don't actually think the behavior is wrong? And so I think our biggest problem is we have this tendency to believe that a law and a policy is the end of the story, but clearly it's not true. If we don't stop and recognize that there are perceptions, social perceptions, that are really guiding, they guide the policy in the first place because it is ideas and attitudes that create policy, but a policy in place is not enough. And if we don't start measuring attitudes, we can't start having the real conversations that are necessary to make the change. You can have all the laws in the world, but if people don't actually abide by them or believe in them, they won't make a difference. And so the pilot is in New York State. My hope is that for 2020, I could do this nationally. And then every 5 years, as a real metric of where we are in this country, but mostly it's to start the correct dialogues. I mean, there's a lot of good dialogues about women, and this is a good year for it, especially in New York State, because of the 100th anniversary. But there's some deeper dialogues about what people are really thinking in their heart. And until we start having that and confronting it, we're not going to be able to make any kind of change. And so to me, this first step is let's get the conversation started. Let's see the reality in front of us so that we can figure out what we have to do to change it.
As you said, we're talking about this poll during the centennial year of when women were granted the right to vote in New York and 2020 nationally. However, given we have a new administration, given the conversations emanating from the policies from this administration, from the talk from this administration, is this a good stage on which to highlight your poll, given we're putting everything out there?
Absolutely. I think it's well, unfortunately, it's always a good stage because the problem is persistently here. But yes, I have been trying to get this survey done for quite a few years. But then when it came down to it, doing it in 2017 felt really important given the 100th year anniversary. Interestingly, we almost ran the survey a week before election, and then we made the decision to do it a week after because we figured we better have the question, who did you vote for, and see how that tied in. And so it actually illuminates quite a bit to some degree what supporters of either side, where they stand, and helps shed some light into the situation. For example, we have questions related to who's better in business and negotiating deals and working out compromises. And so when you have a supporter on one side, you know, a male supporting a male candidate who feel like men are better at doing all of those things, you could kind of understand why they might want someone like that to be their president.
So is there anything surprising or interesting related to the who did you vote for questions concerning women?
Well, yeah, and this was an interesting thing because I've had a number of people challenge me on this finding. But we asked people, what do you view yourself as? Their options were, I consider myself a feminist. I don't consider myself a feminist. I don't use that word, but I do believe in equality between the genders. I'm not sure what feminism means. So there was about 5 different options. And there were people who identified themselves as feminists who voted for Trump. And so a few people came up to me when that was published and said they don't know what a feminist is. They don't know how they're defining it. They say they're a feminist, but that doesn't mean they are. And so it created a lot of dialogue, to say the least, as to how can someone who identifies as a feminist still vote for someone who was publicized as saying some very anti-women statements. And so it's interesting to me. I find it very interesting. I think it, to me, it informs me that there is far more that people who are supportive of Trump weren't necessarily against women. There were other factors that encouraged it. And maybe those factors were strong enough that the way he represented himself to women fell down on the hierarchy of needs, so to speak. But I think it's very interesting. I think it lent itself for some interesting conversations as to who chooses to vote in both directions. Actually, all 4, because we asked about independent and actually non-voters as well.
Is there a policy or something that, if implemented, would help change these social perceptions you're talking about? Or is there a policy we could do away with that would help?
Do I think that there are policies that are not helping the issue? I mean, I could speak to the idea of rape, which is a very heated issue, and actually a few countries have recently released a similar set of questions as to social perceptions of essentially, I would say, victim blaming, but saying that rape is caused by how a woman dresses, agreeing to sex and saying no, drinking and alcohol and substance use. So I think that the one thing I would say is that our current judicial system around rape and sexual assault doesn't quite meld with the social perceptions, in that the evidentiary mandate, which is for any crime, someone is innocent till proven guilty, but this evidentiary mandate creates a situation for women who are reporting rape on their campus or to a police officer. It creates this extreme barrier that when you add in all of these social perceptions and you add these questions of, well, what were you wearing and were you drinking alcohol at the time, that it becomes nearly impossible for these women to see any real justice because it is so heated with social perceptions. So in this short time, could I come up with exactly what policy? I guess one simple one would be the idea that while we don't want to convict someone prematurely, to at least have policies into place to assume, for the woman's sake, for the protections the woman needs, she's telling the truth. Doesn't mean we take the man and lock him up forever, but for whatever protections have to be put into place, a safe place to be, what kind of treatments, that if we assume she's telling the truth right from the beginning and treat her in such a way, then perhaps we could then have a fairer trial. We can have more justice, a better response to these problems. It just, because of so many strong social perceptions, the traditional means of reporting a crime and following through in adjudicating it just gets mogged and bogged down by these social perceptions. And so that would be a great example of how we, if we acknowledge that these social perceptions are there, perhaps by the police officer and by the judge and by the woman herself who thinks that it might be her fault, if we could fight through that a little bit, then maybe we can have a much more cleaner and stronger response to rape and sexual assault.
Anything else you want to get out there?
I sort of said this, but I'll say this again. Because this has never been done before, in many ways, this also serves as a baseline. A metric of how we view our women is very much a metric of where we are as a society. And so just as important as knowing where we are right now is to ideally be able to measure this over time, and perhaps every 5 years is my goal, so that we can see, are we improving or are we declining as a society? Once again, in any country, you could see that how women are viewed really reveals a lot about where the society is.
That was Dr. Eve Waltermore, Director of Research and Evaluation at the Benjamin Center for Public Policy Initiatives at SUNY New Paltz. She was talking about the Women at Work's View on Women poll. College in Susan B. Anthony's Western New York hometown has acquired a trove of 19th century letters she wrote to a fellow leader in the women's rights movement. The University of Rochester says the collection, originally owned by Isabella Beecher Hooker, includes dozens of letters from fellow suffragists Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The collection is now housed in the university's Department of Rare Books, Special Collections, and Preservation. The letters were written between 1869 and 1880 to Hooker, a member of a prominent Connecticut family. The letters were found last year in a wooden box stored at the Bloomfield, Connecticut home of George and Libby Merrow. The letters were passed down through the family of George Merrow, whose grandfather owned the former Hooker House in Hartford. The Kim Lu Sisters was a jazz vocal band born in South Minneapolis in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Today, the daughter of one of the musicians is making a documentary film based on the sisters' surprising story. KFAI's Diane Richard reports.
Perhaps you're familiar with those singing sisters from Minneapolis who tore up the floorboards in the 1940s. Nope, not the Andrews sisters, the Kim Lu sisters.
They became the first Asian American act to star in Broadway musical revues, and they were known as the Chinese Andrews sisters.
That's Leslie Lee, who's making a film about the Kim Lu sisters. She knows the subject well. They were her mother and her aunts.
When I was a child, my mother would start tap dancing when she was waxing the kitchen floor, and they would break into song in four-part harmony during Easter when they were basting the Easter ham.
The Kimmies, as they came to be called, wore their jet black bangs blunt, danced in beaded gowns, and sang with gusto. Their names were Alice, Maggie, Janae, and Patricia.
But she was called Bubbles by her sisters. Because when she was a baby, she blew saliva bubbles from her mouth. Which fit because she had a very, very bubbly personality.
The girls were the products of a Minnesota meet cute story, circa 1915.
My grandmother had just been paid and she had her paycheck in her hand. She was walking across one of the many bridges in Minneapolis, and my grandfather was coming over from the opposite end of the bridge. The wind took it out of her hand. It tumbled across the bridge, and who picked it up on the other side but the man who would be her husband, my grandfather.
The couple soon fell in love. Both had escaped political unrest in their home countries. Lena from Poland, her husband, Shergim Louis, from China. He was a paper son.
Which means that he came over from China with falsified documents, because it was during the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which prevented Chinese laborers from entering the United States.
Lena was a dressmaker, a perfect skill for the soon-to-be stage mom. Her husband was a waiter at the Nankin Cafe.
My mother said it was the finest Chinese restaurant in Minneapolis.
The Nankin is where the family act got its start.
There was a goldfish pond in the middle of the restaurant, and they would use the goldfish pond as their stage setting, and they would sing and they would dance for the patrons of the Nankin Cafe.
In time, the act went from kiddie revues to vaudeville, Broadway, and then, during the war, overseas with the USO. Between gigs, the Kimmies were typical Minnesotans.
They'd go to Powderhorn Park to skate. They just had to make sure they didn't fall and hurt themselves because they had to appear on stage and dance, and they couldn't have skinned knees and broken bones.
Leslie is still working on her documentary. I asked her how strongly the Kimmies identified with their Chinese heritage.
There were a lot of Chinese who did the usual acts of acrobatics, juggling, but they, as my Auntie Bubble said in the film, they were the old Chinese, we were the new, and we didn't do the Chinese type of act. We sang jazz, American jazz.
For it's 1, 2, 3, stretch your out at the old ball game.
Yet the sisters suffered several acts of discrimination, one of them on a train.
The Kim Lu sisters were performing in Canada, and when they reached the border coming back to the United States, the conductor said, "Get these Chinese women off the train." And the three Kimmies, my mother had already married and had left the act by then, thought to themselves, "Well, wait a minute, you know, we're American citizens. What are you saying?"
The train left them at the station. In the film, though, the women look back on their career with anything but bitterness.
Their goal was that we are going to succeed on the stage. That's what Mom wants us to do. We've seen that people like our act. We can't let this racism stop us from succeeding.
The band broke up after the war, and the sisters dispersed. Leslie hopes her documentary pays homage to these women.
You know, at first I thought maybe it's only interesting for me because it's my family. But people kept on saying, this is a really important story, not only a Chinese-American story. This is a very important story because it's an American story.
For KFAI, I'm Diane Richard.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1447.